Welcome to the Majlis, podcast of the Muslim Society's Global Perspectives Project at Queen's University. Majlis is the Arabic word for an assembly, literally a gathering of people sitting together, and it was used for the sessions of learned scholars, philosophers, intellectuals, and artists brought together to discuss and debate. Our podcast intends to accomplish the same purpose of bringing together experts and scholars for discussion and conversation about the politics, histories, cultures of the Middle East, Islamic world, and Muslim diasporas.
You can find the Majlis on your favorite podcast site, including Spotify and Apple iTunes. Don't forget to subscribe and let us know what you think by giving us a rating.
Salam, hello, bonjour, welcome to the Majlis, podcast of the Muslim Society's Global Perspectives Project at Queen's University. I'm your host and director of MSGP, Adnan Hussein, and today I'm very excited to speak with Professor Juan Cole about a new collection of essays and studies he has edited. It's titled Peace Movements in Islam, History, Religion, and Politics. And so we're going to be talking about this subject and what has been included in this volume. But all of you, of course, are aware that Professor Juan Cole is Mitchell Collegiate Professor of History at University of Michigan. He's a translator of Arabic and Persian poetry. He's a public intellectual and blogger whose website, Informed Comment, is really an amazing resource and has just been indispensable over the last couple of decades. He's also author of numerous books, including Muhammad, Prophet of Peace Amid the Clash of Empires. Professor Cole, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Adnan.
Well, it's great to see you again. And I mentioned your fairly recent book, Muhammad, Prophet of Peace, because I remember you describing it at a lecture about the book soon after its publication as a contribution to Islamic peace studies. And this seems to be a real companion work and something that's fulfilling that vision of really defining and giving motive force to Islamic peace studies. So I wanted to ask you first how you got into this subject and what you see as the potential contributions to the field of studying Islam and its relationship to movements for peace.
Well, in some ways, it's autobiographical. I'm from, I came to consciousness politically in the 60s at the time of anti-war demonstrations and a great interest among the youth in the nonviolent philosophy of Martin Luther King and the influence on him of Mahatma Gandhi. Can still remember it was a alternative book publisher, New Directions, that had some of the works of Gandhi. And you would have found me when I was 16 and 17 walking around with them. So I've long been interested in peace movements. And as I became a historian, I've been interested in peace history. And of course, I'm also a specialist in the Middle East, so it wasn't so strange that I would want to put the two together. But they haven't been put together for the most part. Peace studies has become a big field. There are hundreds of MA programs and a few PhD programs in the United States and Europe. And there are centers, there are journals. Peace studies has become professionalized, and some of what it means is looking at the past through the lens of movements and individuals who are searching for peaceful solutions to problems. Those journals typically don't have much in them about Islam or the Muslim world. Of course, there's a big emphasis on Christianity and especially on the peace churches, the Quakers and the Mennonites, to some extent the Roman Catholics, and Roman Catholic institutions like Notre Dame have centers for peace studies. But Islam has been, I think, in our culture in the United States, put under the sign of violence. And for some reason, it hasn't generated a literature in peace studies. And that's something I wanted to change.
Yeah, I mean, it seems that it's almost a stereotype of ways of thinking of Islam, not just in popular, works. What you're talking about is the fact that there's a real absence of scholarship about pursuing, peace movements or theologies of peace, nonviolent studies related to Islam in academia as well. And that there is really, hundreds of studies about explaining, violence or the meaning of jihad and so on. And so this is a very important effort. What have you found? I'm looking, usually this is looked at even in the context of Islam's origins, and it's often located almost genetically, in the religion of Islam at its origins by looking at the career of Prophet Muhammad and also looking at the evidence of the Quran and many verses that do talk about conflict and so on. And so that has been rooted pretty substantially in scholarly perceptions of Islam as a religion, that it can be defined in contrast principally with Christianity as a religion that endorsed or was given birth through violence, that spread through violence. So your first, work in this vein was a very profound and substantial study of the early origins of Islam. So what kind of a contribution was that study and your work on the origins of Islam to really thinking about this concept of peace as relevant to Islamic origins?
Well, I started at the beginning with that book because, as you say, there's a set of prevailing interpretations of the Prophet Muhammad and the Quran and early Islam. The great scholar Patricia Crona at one point talks about Muhammad as a militant prophet. And I understand that she may have changed her mind later on as she got into the text more. I have to say that I think a lot of our colleagues, even those who do Islamic studies, sometimes don't go deeply into the Quran. And so there are, in my view, large numbers of verses which talk about peace as an ideal and how to achieve it in society as a practical ideal. Those haven't generated a literature, unlike, say, Jesus's Sermon on the Mount, about which there are thousands of journal articles and books and sermons and so forth. And of course, I'm talking about academic literature generated in universities. There certainly would be large numbers of Muslim sermons and treatises which dealt with these peace verses. And we know, historical figures like Abdul Ghaffar Khan in British India elaborated an entire social philosophy that encompassed tens of thousands of his followers based on those peace verses. So I'm not saying that nobody has ever noticed this before. I'm just saying that it's not in the academic literature.
Right. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about Abdullah Ghaffar Khan. There's a wonderful piece in this collection by James L. Rowell, who characterizes him as an Islamic Gandhi. What does that comparison imply?
Yeah, well, it's a little bit invidious because we could just as well say that Gandhi is a Hindu Abdul Ghaffar Khan. They were contemporaries.
Right.
Abdul Ghaffar Khan obviously was in Gandhi's circle and cites him, uses some of his terminology. about nonviolence. But he elaborates his own philosophy of nonviolence, insisting that he's finding it in the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
And the field of Muslim peace studies is so vestigial that I don't think people believe him. I don't think that they understood that he really was finding these principles in the Quran. I think he wasn't taken seriously when he said that, but it's clear to me that that's exactly what he meant to say. And of course, many of the verses that we're talking about are from the Mecca period, the first half of the Prophet's ministry. There are, of course, also war verses in the Quran. It was very interesting that the British Indian Muslims living in British India, who took up the struggle to free India of British colonialism, kept insisting, and there's a number of them who've written about this, kept insisting that what the Quran meant by jihad was not war as is understood in contemporary European society. And they keep saying, because they lived through World War II, and they keep saying that that's not what the Quran had in mind. It's not like Hitler's troops marching to, you know, to commit genocide and or these huge battles of you know, both in World War I and World War II, you could have very large number of people killed, mind-bogglingly large numbers. So they kept denouncing European war. They're saying even what we mean by jihad when it's appropriate is not that. And then they would say that in British India, jihad is not appropriate. That what's appropriate is these other peaceful techniques of resistance that the Quran talks about. This is true of Abul Kalam Azad, for instance, and mm-hmm. a number of other Muslim thinkers, and of Abdul Ghaffar Khan. So they found justification for their peaceful techniques in facing British troops who were prepared to deploy violence against them for speaking out, demonstrating, pamphleteering. Their lives were in danger. And Abdul Ghaffar Khan's group, the Red Shirts, or Khodai Khidmat Gar, the servants of God, in Peshawar, in the northwest of what is now Pakistan, stayed nonviolent. You know, there are all these stereotypes we have of peoples. And so the Pushtuns or Pukhtuns of the Northwest were thought of by the British as a martial race, and they liked to induct them into the British Indian Army. They thought they were good fighters. And then to this day with the Taliban, you know, the Pushtuns are somehow tagged as violent. Well, what's very interesting is you had this large movement, some say 100,000 devotees. Those are cadres who actually belonged, and then there would be others who were on the fringes of the movement. A very large movement that was based on peace among the Pushtuns in early 20th century or mid 20th century South Asia. So, as I said, Abdul Ghaffar Khan was imprisoned by the British for his activities, but he always responded peacefully. He asked his followers to do so. And his letters and speeches are full of a kind of Muslim pacifism.
Yeah, it's a very interesting story, and it seems rooted as well in a concept that featured very prominently in one of the other essays in the volume by Asma Afsaruddin, sabr, kind of patient forbearance in the face of challenges and hostility. That seems to be a very important Quranic concept, and also one that seemed to have relevance for subsequent Muslim thinkers, even in this classical period of interpreting the Quran. Yes, as a component of jihad, I wanted to point out. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Asma argues that peace work is a kind of jihad, since the word doesn't mean engaging in violence, as it often is misinterpreted in the United States, including by our FBI. Jihad means struggle. Spiritual struggle is the implication. And if you read all of the verses in the Quran that deploy this term or words like it, it's clear that the vast majority of them have nothing to do with any kind of violence. Now, it may be that one or two verses refer to the wars of self-defense fought by the Medinans against the Meccan pagans who were trying to kill them. It may be that the word is used occasionally in the Quran to refer to that kind of struggle, a struggle of survival on the battlefield. And of course, in later Islamic history, it took on those overtones, and then it became famous when the Muslims were colonized by the Europeans starting in the 18th century. The Muslims would often appeal to the ideals of jihad in fighting off the colonial powers. And so it became a well-known term of horror among the colonialists. They didn't want to see their subjects rise up against them. So I think the word has gathered a lot of freight. It has a lot of baggage. But if we're talking about how the Quran uses it, I would say the vast majority of uses have to do with peaceful struggle, including just arguing. So the Quran says, "Jahidhum bihi," but struggle against them with it by, and the exegetes tell us that with it means by means of the Quran. So there it means perhaps to apologize in the classical sense of to argue your case for your religion. As Asma argues in her fine piece, and this is something she's written a lot about, jihad has these often peaceful overtones, and sabr or patience is another virtue that it doesn't just mean patience. It doesn't mean putting up with things. It's more active than that, and it often has overtones of peace and tolerance. Interestingly enough, and I have no idea if there's a connection, but our word patience comes from the Latin, and in its original Latin form was typically used in the time of the Quran to refer to tolerance. Uh-huh. We now call tolerance. So also in Western languages, there's this connection between tolerance and patience.
Yes. I think another point that your remarks just reminded me of is that the book, the collection, really insists that you have to look at different historical periods as having a very profound influence and effect on the concept. So you can't just interpret the use of various concepts or words or terms without looking at the social, historical, and political environment in which they're being deployed, and also how the interpretations are developing. And so one really fascinating part of the volume was your contribution as well. And I was very intrigued about the kind of sociological basis behind understanding various verses that might deal with the question of tolerance of others, peaceful relations versus, limitations on violence, but kind of developing a kind of ethics of just war. And so you were characterizing in that the difference between the Meccan verses and the Medinan verses, and the different environment, and obviously as a result, the different challenges posed to Muslims, either as individuals or as a collective community that had an independent identity. I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about the Meccan versus about repaying you know, evil with good, and some of the concepts in the Quran there and how you interpret it in that particular context.
Yes, well, I point out that on a number of occasions, the Quran counsels people to repay evil with good, to do good to one's enemies, and says forthrightly that one of the reasons, or that one of the outcomes of doing so, will be that you will win your enemy over, that you will turn an enemy into a patron in the, I think in the Roman sense. A patron was a social superior who did favors for you, and then you did favors for them. So there's a transformative effect of this ethics of doing good to one's enemies and being patient with them, it seems to me, goes beyond actually the Sermon on the Mount, the literature on Jesus's ethics has sometimes pointed out that he does say, do good to your enemies, but he doesn't, it's not dialogical. He doesn't go on to describe what effect that would have on the enemy. It seems to be a very personal thing that you should do good to your enemies for the sake of your soul. But what kind of interaction is there? What kind of dialogue is there as a result? That the New Testament doesn't go into, although some later Christian literature does. But the Quran is dialogical. It's saying, do good to your enemies, pray for them, pray for security and peace and prosperity for them, respond to their taunts and their acts of aggression peacefully. And in so doing, you will begin the work of transforming them spiritually and will gain a patron. And I should underline that I don't think that these ideals are only in the Meccan period. I think that they're also spoken of in what are generally considered the Medina surahs. And I think that the reason that there are also verses about warfare in the Medina period is that the social situation changed. As you said, I think there's a sociology of these ethics. And so there was no state in the time that the Prophet Muhammad was preaching in Western Arabia. The Roman Empire had collapsed in the Middle East, and so the nearest state in Yemen and in Syria and so forth was the Iranian Sasanian Empire, but it didn't seem to have Mecca and Medina. It may have wanted them, but it didn't have them. So there was no state. The Arabic speaking people of Western Arabia were what is called acephalous, and there were clans. There were clan feuds. There were some structures of authority, but they were vague, and there was no centralization. So, in such a situation, I think the Quran's teachings about doing good to one's enemies, forgiving one's enemies, and so forth, were intended to deal with this situation where there was no state, and in the Medina period, where the Prophet and his followers emigrated to the nearby city of Yathrib or Medina, a statelet grew up, and the Prophet Muhammad was at its center. And Mecca was a sanctuary city. The ancient Arabic-speaking people had a custom of recognizing shrines to the divine as places where you're not allowed to pursue vendettas and feuds. So there was no fighting in Mecca. And so I think the early believers around Muhammad were not in great danger of their lives as long as they were in Mecca. Of course, those are ideals, and the Meccan pagans seem to have begun breaking the ideal and being hard on the early followers of Muhammad. And so they left and went to Medina, which is not a sanctuary. It's not recognized as a sanctuary. And so the pagans could attack it militarily. And all the Quran really says is that when people attack you, you know, fight back and defend yourselves. And of course, your innocence, that your women and children and so forth need to be defended, which, by the way, is the teaching of the church fathers who were in the centuries leading up to Muhammad, St. Augustine, St. Ambrose. That's where the Catholic idea of a just war comes from, is from those church fathers who thought that it was necessary to take up arms to defend the innocent. So I don't think there's anything unusual or even very distinctive about the Quran's teachings on this subject. I think it does make clear that it's talking about defensive war, because it says, you know, you can attack those that attack you, but don't be an aggressor. And there are several verses to that effect. But alongside a just war theory, which is new in the Medina period because the situation is new in the Medina period, the Quran continues to counsel reconciliation with one's enemies and to avoid making enemies if at all possible. And the just war is the last resort when nothing else has worked and they're coming for your five-year-old daughter with their sword, then you're going to have to fight back.
Right, right. Well, and I think also the essay, it's very interesting that it does seem to benefit a lot from these comparisons. And I would say that, you know, in general, the broad framework of peace studies has, you know, characterized Islam rather negatively in terms of the comparison with Christianity. So it's quite interesting that by looking at similar issues and how they're dealt with in late antique Christian sources, that is the contemporary or immediate backdrop to the emergence of Islam, you end up seeing quite a lot of continuities, as you point out in the essay, sort of similarities of approach that reaffirm the thesis that you have had in your other work, that it was an ecumenical religious movement that had a lot to do with you know, late antique religiosity, basically, and isn't out of step with that, which is why it's also interesting that you pointed out that you thought in some components it might have even gone a little further in this dialogical approach, which maybe is something distinctively, you know, Islamic, and always envisioning, you know, these ethical principles within a communal context of the social ethics that are involved. But so anyway, I really enjoyed the use of these Christian parallels to evince how this is, you know, not something, well, that it should be understandable, you know, for people, not to exaggerate, you know, Islam's distinctive orientation. It's just that, you know, it encompasses a slightly different situation than that described by the Gospels in the early period. So once you have, you know, interpretation by the church fathers for, you know, Roman imperial era society in the Near East, they're going to end up coming up with solutions and ideas that are actually somewhat similar to what Islam was developing at the same time. I think that's a very, you know, important point that your essay now and the previous book on Muhammad really brings out very clearly. But turning to some of the other periods, maybe, since we've been talking about origins and pre-modern, I wanted to come back to some of the more recent examples. I noticed that Rashid Rida appears rather prominently in two different essays. And of course, I mean, you could better tell people, since you're a modern historian of the Middle East as well, about who Rashid Rida is. But I would say in general, he has been seen as a kind of Salafist, reformist thinker and journalist who was advocating a particularly, let's say, stringent version of Islam in response to the need to reform, you know, Muslim societies away from what were seen as medieval accretions that had weakened the core of the faith and retarded its social and intellectual and scientific technological development as a modern society. So he's not someone who's usually associated with what we would think of as peace movements. And yet we have two essays that really give different inflections to his career and interests, at least particularly in the earlier part of his career.
Yes, Rashid Rida was from Ottoman Syria. And as a young person, had heard about the reformist efforts of Jamal ad-Din Afghani and Muhammad Abdu, who were prominent late 19th century Muslim reformers. And he initially dreamed of going and working with al-Afghani, and who had gone to Istanbul. But Afghani died before Rida could make those arrangements as a young person. And so he decided to go to Cairo and work with Afghani's disciple, Muhammad Abdu, who had become a very prominent Muslim figure. And I should underline, as a historian, that I think this movement that Afghani and Abdu and Rida were involved in was called the Salafi movement, referring to the earliest generation of Muslims around the Prophet, and their followers. So the movement was attempting to recover Islam as it was practiced by the early community. Those were the pious ancestors, Salaf as-Saleh. Afghani Abdu and Rida, when he was a young person at least, did not advocate for any form of fundamentalism. Rather, the movement was about reinjecting reason and science and modernity into Islam. And to be fair, Islam in its history was often at the forefront of whatever modernity was at the particular period. There were great Muslim scientists and astronomers and mathematicians and logicians and so forth. But they felt that in the late 19th century, Islam had become hidebound, that the clerical core had descended into just memorizing medieval glosses and texts, as you said, and that they should slough this off. So Abdu corresponded with Tolstoy. Thought about modern science and its implications for Islam. He allowed modern banking interest. He became rector of the Al-Azhar Seminary, which is the preeminent Muslim Sunni Muslim teaching institution. And so his legal rulings came to have a lot of authority. He permitted Muslims to have good social relations with Jews and Christians, have them over for dinner and so forth. So the movement was open-minded. And Rida was not a Wahhabi. He didn't follow the precepts of the religious reform movement in Saudi Arabia. And in fact, Rida has an essay on the difference between Sunnism and Wahhabism, in which he says that in Wahhabism, the default for any new phenomenon in the world that is not mentioned in the classical Muslim texts, in the Quran and the sayings and doings of the Prophet and the companions or the Hadith, the default in Wahhabism is that it's not allowed. So the Wahhabis were against radio when it first appeared and so forth. They're kind of like the Amish in this regard. Abdu said that, or Rida said that for Sunnis, the default is that it's allowed if it's not forbidden, and more especially if it is found useful to the community.
Right.
So I think In our time, the word Salafi has completely switched around its meaning and come to mean Sunnis who kind of approximate to Wahhabis. That's the opposite of what it used to mean in the early 20th century. So yes, and Rida became more conservative over time. And one of the things that our essays show is why. So for instance, Elizabeth Thompson argues that if you read Rida's journal, he had great hopes for the League of Nations and for the post-World War I settlement. And you know, President Wilson had put forward the 14 points and self-determination was one of them. And silly them, the Arabs thought that maybe self-determination would apply to them. Wilson had in mind the Czechs, who had been part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, that as those Central European empires dissolved, that people should, the peoples should have self-determination. But he wasn't thinking about the former Ottoman subjects in the same way, I don't think. And in any case, the movers and shakers at Versailles, the British and the French politicians, certainly did not look at them that way. They looked at them the way a hungry person looks at an apple. So they were denied self-determination after World War I and put under a new regime of colonialism, which had a different name. They were called protectorates, but I mean, it's the same thing.
The mandates, right. The
mandates, right. And the mandates were kind of a juvenilization of the people of the Middle East, that they were imagined as teenagers not quite ready, you know, to stand on their own two feet. So they'd have to be in school another couple of years before they could become independent. And the British and the French would kindly supply them with those tools and allow them to become independent down the line. Rida, in his writing, between the end of World War I and the time it finally became clear that the Arabs were going to have a dagger in their backs. In those years, though, he talked a lot about the end of war and the beginning of a period of peace and the hopes for the League of Nations and the Arab peoples as independent countries which would join the League of Nations and have a voice in shaping this new post-World War I period. And remember, the politicians used to say that the Great War, World War I, was the war to end all wars. Well, a lot of people hoped that it was, because it was the most destructive war up until that period. But then Rida was disappointed by the outcome and the reimposition of colonialism. The French marched in and took what is now Lebanon and Syria, and then divided them and ruled them as colonies the way it ruled Morocco. In fact, some of the same soldiers were brought in, and the British took over Iraq and Palestine, and then divided it into Palestine and Transjordan. Rida became a little bitter about those things. So Thompson is really talking about that period in which he was
right.
World peace.
Well, and listeners of this podcast will remember our conversation with her actually about her book, How the West Stole Democracy from the Arabs, and about the very progressive constitution that had been proposed in the 1920 Syrian Arab kind of meetings that were taking place right after the end of World War One. So he was, of course, an author or instrumental, at least in putting together that constitution. And I guess you could say, I don't know if you would agree, I mean, I think certainly it's been Elizabeth Thompson's thesis in other of her work, that some of the turns perhaps towards religious conservatism could be described by different waves of disappointment. after hopes were dashed about the possibilities for independence, liberation, or the wave during the 50s, 60s for, progress under Arab socialism, were dashed, that the history, of the modern Middle East could in some part be described, or at least these movements or turns towards religiously conservative interpretations as a way of responding to these disappointments, and failures of other kinds of politics. But it seems like Rashid Ridda also, worked on an interesting kind of area, theologically speaking, in terms of accommodating other religions and religious communities that would seem to be pretty important to lay foundations for a modern sense of a multi-religious society and how it could be governed, by thinking about the problem of the salvation of Jews and Christians and other non-Muslims, that was somewhat progressive and seems to have gone much further than even some of the insights or arguments made by medieval Muslim theologians like Al-Ghazali, who had seen, a place for salvation for Christians and Jews in a Muslim sense of salvation history. And so there's an essay here looking at Ridda's work on that front. What did you think was the kind of key argument or developments in Rashid Ridda's thought on this topic?
Well, Muhammad Khalil, who wrote that chapter, has done a lot of work on this issue. And the big surprise is that, again, although Muslims are often thought of as hidebound and somewhat fanatical about their faith and consigning the infidels to hellfire and so forth, he found that there's a strong trend in medieval Muslim thought towards acceptance of a universal salvation. Although the Quran is eloquent about the horrors of hellfire for pagans, it's been argued that medieval Muslim theologians came to see those verses as about a kind of purgatory. And that ultimately, once people had been sufficiently punished for their polytheism or whatever sin it was that they had committed, that they would be rehabilitated. Again, I think there's a real sense of Islamic community, and since all the entire human community ultimately has to be has to be saved, no matter what right. they did, and so Ridda was well read in modern European thought and had arguments with Christian missionaries and so forth. So he's a very cosmopolitan person in many ways. And so he elaborated on this notion of the ultimate salvation of the other. Jean-Jacques Rousseau once suggested that no matter what you say about being tolerant and having good relations with others and so forth, if you think they're going to hell, you don't really respect them.
Right.
So I think Ridda is saying that he's willing to respect everyone. And again, it's not to say that people won't go to hell, but they had this belief, the Muslim theologians, that it wouldn't be forever. And of course, there are lots of Muslim theologians that have been through history who thought it is forever. I asked Muhammad Khalil about this. I said, well, what about those people who say that, there's a verse in the Quran says, Khalidun fiha, that they'll be eternally in the flames of hell. And he said, yes, but there are other verses where it says, except if God will. And I think that's a really distinctive and important principle in Islamic thought, and it's been called Islamic occasionalism. A lot of medieval Muslim thinkers didn't think that trees just grow by themselves. They're growing because God wants them to grow. If God decides that he's going to save them all in the end, after they've been scourged, then they will be. And how could you argue with that?
Right, right. Well, I mean, it also does remind me, as a result of the first essay in the volume, a contribution by Rashid Omar, that tried to talk about how the principle of justice, which is one of the principal themes of the Quran, and certainly how modern Muslim activists tend to approach and understand their faith through the lens of seeking justice, social justice, and so on, can't overemphasize it to the detriment of an equally, or if not more important, principle established in the Quran, and certainly in the invocation ahead of each of the chapters of the Quran, that reaffirms, read this, you know, surah, this following part of scripture, with remembering that God is the most merciful and the most compassionate. So that ideal of rahmah, as a kind of balancing principle, and perhaps even sometimes a superior principle that abrogates, you know, simple, narrow justice, you know, was an interesting point, and it seems relevant to that discussion about the salvation of others, is that you have to also remember that, you know, God is the most merciful as well.
Yeah, it's an important principle in the whole history of Islamic thought. There's this verse that I discussed in my essay, that the servants of the All-Merciful walk humbly upon the earth. And when, you know, the rowdy or the ignorant harass them, they reply, peace be upon you, you know, wishing peace and prosperity on this enemy. And the Sufis went wild with this, because it begins by saying the servants of the All-Merciful. So the Sufis are saying that these are the Muslims who have taken on board God's attribute of mm-hmm. mercy and really internalized it. And then they're able to treat their enemies in this way. I've actually written a piece which will appear eventually on the Sufi interpretation of that verse. This is another essay, the one that we're talking about, which comes out of a situation. So the author had been, as a young person, involved in the anti-apartheid movement. Mm-hmm. And about 1% of South Africans are Muslim, but they punch above their weight. They have been particularly prominent in a number of movements. And there was, frankly, a debate amongst them they had, you know, been brought as indentured servants and things in the 19th century from, in many cases, India. Some have a Malay background. They're polyglot kind of community. But the in really, as apartheid was really getting going, the whites tried to divide what were called the coloreds from the blacks. And so they granted them citizenship, and they had been in a very tenuous situation before then. So there was a big debate in the community, is do we want to rock this boat? The young people said yes. Then the question was, well, do we protest apartheid because it's affecting us? And just as Muslims from the mosque with preachers, or do we actually join in with broader anti-apartheid groups? And again, there was a dispute. There were even Muslims who at that time in the 80s had been kind of influenced by the Khomeini revolution in Iran and kind of turned inwards, but were also anti-imperialist. And so they protested on their own, but Rashid was one of those who joined with the broader anti-apartheid groups, churches and civil groups and so forth. And there was a whole section of Muslims that did that, many of whom went on to become important thinkers for the community. So peace thought always has a context, and the peaceful actions of the anti-apartheid Muslims is an important part of this story.
Indeed, and that reminds me, I know you've been very generous with your time, so I don't want to take you for too much longer, but it does remind me about those movements that the latter part of the book looks at several different movements with contributions from Sherman Jackson about a turn towards nonviolence and rejection of violence by a kind of what would be seen as a radical group in Egypt, the Islamic group that had actually engaged in violent attacks, to Bosnian women in a multi-faith environment after the war, trying to promote peace and healing among those communities and the traumas, to Muslim activists and social movements during contemporary American life, today struggling to deal with Islamophobia and exclusion. And you include all of these different essays as part of peace movements in Islam as kind of practical examples of work on the ground in a grassroots way. Do you have anything you'd want to say about how that fits into what we've been talking about, which much more the sort of theological and conceptual ideas about Islamic values and peace. But these actual movements are quite interesting as well in the study of peace movements in Islam.
Yes, well, the book was intended to show a wide range of peace activism and peace thinking among Muslims. And I should acknowledge we got funding from the International Institute of the University of Michigan for this project, Samer Ali and I, my colleague there, and we were able to have two conferences. The bulk of the book comes out of papers presented at those conferences. And when IB Taurus, which is an imprint now of Bloomsbury, took on the book, they came back to me and they said, "We think this book could be field forming, but we want you to add some things." So there were a few contributions like the one on contemporary America or Bosnia that I went out and solicited after the fact to get this wide range. And I would say in the modern period, there are two kinds of peace activism we can see among Muslims. One was the anti-colonial, because the Muslim world was largely colonized by the British, the French, the Dutch, the Belgians, and so forth. How to get rid of the colonial regimes became a pressing question in the first half of the 20th century. And by the mid-20th century, mostly such movements had succeeded. In some instances, they were violent, as with Algeria. But in others, they took a peaceful path. And so, like the great Sufi leader Amadou Bamba of Senegal explicitly said that the time of jihad was something that pertained to the Prophet Muhammad, and we're not good enough any longer as Muslims to aspire to that level. And so we should pursue peaceful means of resisting the French, because it's just not our station in life to put on those kinds of airs. When the French called him a jihadi or a mujahid, someone who fought jihad, he said, "Yes, these people who have a trinity and have made God into three gods and so forth—they accuse me of this, and they are right. I am a mujahid of the pen. I'm a fighter with the pen, a mujahid of al-ilm of knowledge." Jihad of the pen became a really important theme in the Murid Sufi order in Senegal. After decolonization, and we get into the more contemporary period, you've seen Muslims caught up in post-colonial wars, basically, or in the case of the former Yugoslavia, post-Soviet collapse, has been a rocky road, and we're seeing it now unfold in the Ukraine. But the former Yugoslavia went to war. You had Croatians and Bosnians and Serbs, who, contrary to what some journalism alleges, had perfectly good relations for the previous decades. And it's not the case that there are age-old hatreds in the Balkans. It's that from time to time, people hate, and it can happen very quickly. Mm-hmm. And I think when a governmental system collapses and there's a vacuum, people trot out these religious and ethnic identities as a way to seek power or to defend their communities. So in the aftermath of that war, when things settled back down and you had NATO peacekeepers, the Muslims in Bosnia engaged in peace work and attempts at conciliation. It was a horrible situation, so it wasn't easy to conciliate. There were genocides, and our author, Professor Siljak, talks about especially the women, and I was interested to have, you know, this book not be about men, to have women. We have a number of women authors, but then we also have some discussion of women peace activists among the Muslims, and the Bosnian women seem particularly active in this front.
Indeed. Well, I mean, it's a really remarkable collection, and I do hope it is, in fact, discipline launching, creating a real field. As you point out, it's still in its infancy. There are a few works that have been of scholarship that have been written on the subject before this collection, but hopefully this will inspire some reflection and ferment and creativity in being able to reimagine some of the hidebound categories in which we've been thinking about and studying Islam and Muslims, to open up to some of the phenomena that have existed historically and contemporaneously that contribute to active social justice movements, what you refer to in the book as positive peace movements, as opposed to just opposition to war or adherence to nonviolence, but actual, you know, creating social conditions of just peace, I think was a phrase that I picked up in reading this, that's parallel to just war theory, but just peace theory. And that this will launch a lot of new scholarship. I look forward to that. I think it's a major contribution. I encourage our listeners to pick up this book, Peace Movements in Islam, History, Religion, and Politics, edited by Professor Juan Cole. It's published by I.B. Taurus, and you can find it all over. I think it'll repay your interest. But I really appreciate you coming on to talk about the book and its various essays with us on the Majlis.
Thank you so much, Adnan.
My pleasure. Listeners, how would listeners find out about your work? I mean, they should be able to find it everywhere, but if they want to follow you if you want to plug anything about your recent work besides this book, what should listeners look out for?
Oh, I'm easily Googled. They should just Google Juancole or any search engine that they typically use, and it'll come right up.
Well, they can follow you on Twitter as well, I think.
Yes, my handle at Twitter is at JRICOLE.
Great. And of course, everyone should already know about Informed Comment, a great resource on everything that's going on in the world. So do check that out. And again, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us in the Majlis, a podcast by MSGP. Muslim Society's Global Perspectives, or MSGP, is an initiative at Queen's University dedicated to connecting the complex history of Islamic societies with the contemporary world. You can connect, learn more, and support us by checking out our website, www.queensu.ca/MSGP, and stay up to date with our events by following us on Twitter at MSGPQU and on our Facebook, MSGPQU. You can also follow our YouTube channel, The Mejlis.